Talking Books on News Talk 106 to 108.
As soon as I started writing about a missing girl, I didn't want to write a novel about a missing girl. You know, it's been done a lot, and it's often done in a way which ends up being about the body of a missing girl, and the girl kind of just becomes an object. And I didn't want to go down that route. But nevertheless, that was my starting point, and I had this image in my mind of the search party and the whole village turning out to look for this child who's vanished. And it was such a strong image in my mind, and as soon as I started writing about it, I found lots of characters and lots of kind of interrelationships between these characters, and I was really excited about writing about this village that I'd begun to invent. So I didn't want to let go of the idea, but at the same time, I didn't want it to become a book that was a kind of crossword puzzle for the reader of like, here are some clues, here's some more clues, here's something you think might have happened, and it turns out this has happened. I don't have a problem with those kind of books, but it wasn't the kind of book I wanted to write.
What are the benefits of living in a small town? And is non-fiction the new fiction? Hello, how are you? And you're very welcome to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. Well, on tonight's show, I'm coming to you from the 2017 West Cork Literary Festival in beautiful breezy Bantry, where the best in Irish and international writing talent gave a series of workshops, readings and improvised chats to the backdrop of Bantry Bay. This year's lineup included the likes of Sarah Moss, Carol Drinkwater, Lara Marlowe, Colm Tobin, Anne Enright, John McGregor, Eileen Battersby, Emer McBride and the great Graeme Norton. So tonight we're going to enjoy some highlights from the festival. First up, Angola Thought Me Beckett, the compelling words of British writer, memorist and journalist Lara Pawson.
My name is Lara Pawson, and I'm here at the West Cork Literary Festival for I was invited to have a conversation about my second book called This Is The Place To Be, published by CB Editions. I had a conversation with the wonderful novelist Sarah Baum, who was extremely generous and clever. I've never been here before. I have written one other book. My first book was called In the Name of the People, Angola's Forgotten Massacre, published by IB Taurus. That was a more conventional piece of writing. My recent book, This Is The Place To Be, is an experimental, fragmentary memoir. That would wrap it up in three words. The first book was investigative reportage, but written in the first person. So kind of unconventional in some ways. And I'm now working on fiction. So I've moved steadily further and further away from my I suppose, main career, if I ever had a career, as a journalist at the BBC. Before that, I worked for an MP. I've taught politics, but I was too strict. And now I do a bit of book reviewing. I work a bit with refugees. I live in London for my sins. I'm very angry about Brexit. I could keep telling you lots of things about myself. I'm 49. That's enough.
Really well done in your talk today. It was very, very interesting, and congratulations on the book. I was interested to hear that the memoir started out, you described it as a warm-up, warm-up piece that you wrote for an experimental theatre group. Yeah. It's a very interesting approach to take.
Well, yeah, I mean, it was a slightly alarming thing when it became a real piece of work that people were going to listen to in the Battersea Arts Centre in South London. In fact, it also went to Belgium and was played there in a theatre in Belgium. But it started out as a warm-up exercise for a kind of prompt that I was sent by a theatre director in Manchester, who said, you know, read these texts by Joe Brainard, American poet, modernist writer, Georges Perec, Edouard Levé, so basically French and American poets, avant-garde poets and writers. I was sent four texts, told to listen to them and to respond to them in any way I saw fit. And basically I sat down at my computer, I read the texts, in one of the cases I watched a video, and I started writing. And basically I wrote the first 25,000 words of this is the place to be, although I didn't know then it was going to be this is the place to be. I thought it was just something I'd be sending to this theatre director that would then probably get trashed and we'd produce something completely different. And to cut quite a long story short, it ended up becoming actually, I suppose, a sound installation. It was played, it was recorded by a woman called Kathy Naden, an actor, and it was played out of a radio in what appeared to be a bit like a sitting room, and it was called Non-Correspondence. So it was effectively, I suppose, the sort of stuff that you never hear from a foreign correspondent. It was the kind of anti-correspondence. So it was called Non-Correspondence, and it ran as a radio piece, sound installation, inside a theatre. And then I went on holiday, and I met a man called Weaver, and Weaver said to me, you should try and get this published as a book. And I said, you know, you must be fucking joking. I don't want people to read this stuff because it's quite personal. My husband said, you know, he's right. Why not try and get it published as a book? So I ended up sending it to CB Editions, Charles Boyle. He really liked it. He said, expand it. I wrote another 20,000 words and it became the book.
Lara, it's an unbelievably courageous piece of writing. As I was progressing through it, I couldn't believe just how honest and rawly honest you were. And I don't think I could commit some of the stuff that you've written to paper and be as honest with myself. And I don't think a lot of people have such honest conversations with themselves at certain stages in their life. And I'm just wondering, how vulnerable did you feel when you were committing some of your thoughts to paper? Because you write about sexual violence, you write about issues related to abortion, some family stuff. You touch on a lot of heavy duty stuff. And within all of that, you also jump around within how you tell the story. So there's a flippancy in one way. It's very, very creative.
Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the reasons it could be courageous, as you call it, although I'm not sure it was courageous, I think it was because I just thought I was doing this for myself. I was just warming up for whatever this theatre director was going to ask me to do next. I didn't imagine it was going to become a final text. So it was a bit like writing a diary, you know, not that you'd write a diary like that, some people might, but I didn't imagine it was going to become something that would ever be heard by other people. So I think that was what has created in the end this sense of it being very brave, is because effectively I was just talking to myself. And, you know, I'm sure that all of us, we have thoughts and ideas that we wouldn't, and desires that we would never share with other people because we're ashamed of them or we're embarrassed or we think they're wrong. So then when it became a real thing and a kind of work of art that was going to be presented to a public, I was quite uneasy, and I didn't tell anybody I knew about it, apart from my husband, obviously did know about it, because I thought, God, I don't want anyone to know that this is me. Then when it became a book, I did have a few moments when I thought maybe I should pull it, maybe I shouldn't do this. But I tend to be somebody who, you know, I think, for example, when I was working in Angola, you know, years ago as a journalist, I think that, you know, I used to go into places that were very dangerous where the war was taking place, and people say, oh, you must be very brave. And I thought, I'm not very brave. It's more that I'm quite good at overcoming my fears. But I do feel very, very afraid. But I just think, you only live once. Just see what happens. Go out there and see what happens. And I think with the book, I thought, fuck it, you know, I might be dead tomorrow. Who knows what's coming around the corner? We've got so many weird things happening in the world. Just do it and see what happens, and to hell with it. And I am quite spontaneous in that way. And I've been amazed by the response to it, that people have been very generous, and it has connected with, obviously not everybody, but quite a lot of people it's resonated with them. And people who've surprised me. I mean, I've had responses from old men from very different backgrounds to me. It was an old man from a very working class background I met in London recently, who heard me at a reading, and he said, I could identify with 85% of that. Can I give you a hug? And I thought, blimey, I've just been talking about my genitals, you know, and I was absolutely kind of gobsmacked that he felt like that. And I thought, maybe it's just that people, I don't know, there's a kind of human beings. You know, we can connect with each other, and we have to take risks to do that.
But possibly also that some readers will be so refreshed by, you know, the brutal honesty in it, and that we live to a degree with a lot of phony stuff, with a lot of controlled media and understandings, and there is a huge freedom to reading the book.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. It's interesting for me to hear you saying that, because I suppose, you know, you're right, there is a lot of bullshit, isn't there? But then, you know, yes, there's lots of that, but there's also many, many moments that happen in all our lives where we connect with real people. You see people, certainly where I live, you see people begging. I see 11-year-olds selling drugs outside my back gate. I see the lady and the man across the road, a very old couple who can't find anyone to look after them. They end up getting sent to a home where they're not being looked after properly. We have reality thrust in our face all the time, and I think I do feel, I suppose, from my experience of life, I feel it's really important to cut through the crap and say it as you see it. And I think that's probably what quite a lot of people feel, and perhaps do. I think a lot of people do that in their day-to-day lives, but you don't hear about them. You know, people who work as teachers or people, nurses, they work with that kind of thing every day, but they're just not writing books about it, so we don't hear about them. But they're dealing with, you know, wiping people's arses and clearing up horrible cuts and things. They have to deal with that reality all the time. So the least you can do as a writer, which is a very undangerous job, you're just sitting at your computer tapping on keys, is to try and be as brave as you can. Surely that's one of the things we have to try and do.
Can we talk about your time in Angola? And I know that you've quite a personal relationship with the country. You've a lot of friends from there that you describe some of the most beautiful times in your life were in Angola, and also some of the most shocking and challenging. You talk a bit about how being, you describe yourself as being quite paranoid, or lived quite a paranoid existence over there, and that in one way that paranoia allowed you to be a good journalist and kept you safe. I thought that was very interesting.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point, because I think I'm still quite paranoid. If you spoke to if my husband was standing here, he'd just roll his eyes and say, God, she's so bloody paranoid, it drives me around the bend. But I think that, it's interesting, the idea of paranoia and journalism being a successful combination. I wonder if that's actually true. I think it's that I don't trust people in power anywhere, whether they're British, Angolan, Irish, you know, I don't care where they're from. I don't trust power, and I don't trust people with power. And I think once you begin to see how power works, it can make you paranoid. I mean, if you follow the news of Trump and his sons and Russia, crikey, if people aren't paranoid yet, I kind of think paranoia is quite a healthy response to the world we live in. But I just want to go back to the point you made about Angola, because I feel like I have to be quite honest about this. You know, I went to Angola for the first time nearly 20 years ago in 1998, and I was there for 2.5 years, and then I went back 3-4 times for several months at a time. I haven't been there since 2008, and I have some very good friends near where I live in London who are Angolan. But I think I would be lying if it would be wrong of me to give the impression that I'm still deeply connected with the country, because the country altered me profoundly. It altered the way I see the world. I think the experience of living in a place with a war, and a war that had been fueled by foreign powers, America, Soviet Union, Cuba, among others, you start to, if I had a naive understanding of the world from growing up in a very privileged middle-class background in London, it was blown apart while I was there. And it's shaped the way I understand Europe now. It's shaped the way I understand British history. So I'm much more critical now of, and did become so while I was there. I started to understand how much hypocrisy there was in Europe and the West, about particularly about sub-Saharan African countries. So I think that I wouldn't want to kind of claim a relationship with Angola that was false, because I think in some ways that's almost a past part of me. And my time living there and living in places like Ivory Coast and Mali has actually made me look at Britain in a different way. And now that we live in this kind of awful joke that is Brexit Britain, I feel I need to dig into my own country and actually, you know, the fight now is there and I need to stay there and confront the truth of what a joke my country is and the kind of arrogance of my country, sort of thinking it's still some kind of empire. And the battle needs to take place there. There's you know, and all the migrants who are trying to come in and who are being kicked out. We've got so many problems that we need to face there. So I'm slightly going off on a tangent, but I suppose what I'm saying is that having seen countries torn apart far away, I think it's not that far off in Britain at the moment.
And I suppose violence isn't just a factor that happens in war.
I know
that you describe in the memoir the house somebody was murdered on your road.
And
you're living in London.
That's the thing. I mean, I think I've been a bit taken aback by some people who said, someone the other night said, oh, you talk about the, you know, your book's all about brutality and violence in Angola. And I said, no, it's not. I said, the whole point of the book is actually to show how much violence there is in Britain. People being murdered. I've suffered sexual violence only in Britain, not in other places. It's happened in Britain. It actually happened in London. You know, women get raped or are beaten up by their husbands on my street. You know, it's so. I think there's sort of, yeah, I try to challenge that and to say, look at where we come from and look at our history. We export violence. I mean, we're experts at this stuff. Violence is part of human nature. It's not something particular to certain groups in certain parts of the world. Yeah, I feel very strongly about that.
I was very interested in what you wrote about and how members of the public, wherever they are, whether they're from America, England, Europe, wherever, that they misunderstand war and that they misunderstand the work of journalists. Obviously, you've spent a lot of time thinking about this and it's and reflecting on it. Do you find it very frustrating, possibly, how war is presented by media? There's almost the turn-on factor, the excitement factor, and it's also stimulating in one way. But there is the brute reality of the deep impact on the ground. And that sometimes we just walk away from all of that and move on to the next thing.
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, it's funny because there's so many contradictory things. I mean, I can remember reporting on a plane crash in Luanda. A plane had come down, it had crashed in Luanda on top of a shanty town. So lots of houses had been crashed into and people had been killed and there were body parts. You could see arms and legs. And when I did my live two-way, my live interview to London about this crash, after I'd finished the interview, the editor said that I had been too graphic in my descriptions of what I could see around me. And I felt then very strongly, look, I can see bits of bodies, I can see people screaming and people in a state of high trauma. That is what's happening. That's what I'm going to report. Of course, you know, part of the debate on all of this stuff is that there are very violent films that people are seeing because of 24-hour, 24/7 TV news. People just see recirculating images all the time of violence. And this has actually happened quite close to home now with things like the Grenfell Tower. The fire that happened there was, for me, quite a major turning point, actually, in sort of Britain's understanding of violence, because the way it was reported was the way that we quite often see other parts of the world being reported, and the way that the journalists, quite a lot of, not all of them, but some of the journalists went in and just stuck their microphones under people's noses who were still didn't know if their children were alive or if their neighbours had got out of the tower. But the journalists were so hungry to get the news to send back to their editor that seemed not to matter. I mean, I think it's difficult because I think we do need to know the truth and I think people do need to report what they can see and we need to face the horrors of this world straight on and not duck out of them. But because of the mediated world in which we live, because you can turn on the telly and see violence all the time, everywhere, anywhere, frankly, I worry that we are... that when you see it, you're not actually understanding it as something that's happening to other human beings. And that was one of the reasons in the end why I left Angola as a correspondent, was because I felt I worried that I was becoming numb to what I was seeing. So I would go into a centre of displaced people who were very, very malnourished, And I wasn't as upset as I first was, inevitably, because I was getting used to it. But it worried me that I was becoming too thick-skinned. And I think for me, that's a sort of permanent project, to not become so blasé about homeless people in London that I don't stop and notice them, and I don't stop and talk to them, and I don't stop and ask them how they are, because each individual homeless person is suffering and has a story to tell. I think to some extent, I mean, I don't want to sound too kind of poncy, and I don't want to get too philosophical and about this, but I do think that in life we need to remain alert to human suffering, and I don't think the mediated world helps us do that.
British writer and journalist Lara Pawson. This is A Place to Be is published by CB Editions and retails for just under €12 in paperback. Now, on Sunday evening last, novelist John Boyne and Sarah Moss took to the stage at the Maritime Hotel. Afterwards, I got a chance to talk to John about his latest book, The Heart's Invisible Furies. I asked John what prompted the novel.
Well, I started writing it about 18 months before the Equal Rights Marriage Referendum of 2015. And it was around the time when we knew that referendum was going to happen. There was a very strong chance it was going to pass. So I was thinking about that. I was thinking about how Ireland had changed so much in a relatively short space of time. I was a student in Trinity in the early 90s when homosexuality was still a criminal offence. It wasn't decriminalised until 1993. And it occurred to me that Ireland, which had been this a real bastion of conservatism, Catholicism over the years, in less than a quarter century, would go from there to being the first country in the world that would vote by public plebiscite for equal rights marriage. I've lived in Ireland all my life. I am Irish. I wanted to see how that change had come about.
Tell me, what does it mean to be a gay man in Ireland today?
I think things are very, very different. I mean, it depends on what age you are. I'm 46 now. If I was 18, it would mean absolutely nothing. Kids these days are so open to each other's sexuality, to difference. If anything, kids today embrace that in a way that they didn't when I was 18. And if I was a lot older than I am, if I was in my 70s or 80s, I think there would be a part of me that would feel happy about the changes, but resentful too, that, why wasn't my life easier? Why wasn't things different when I was younger? So I'm in the middle age group there where I mean, nobody cares anymore. I don't think it's never been an issue for me. I came out to my family and my parents when I was, 21, 22. And it never really, I don't have any great trauma stories, thankfully. I know a lot of people would have, but I just don't really. My family were very accepting of it and I just kind of got on with my life. So it's, I guess the only difficulty is still kind of meeting people, because it's still a small percentage of the population. And, if you're hoping to, I was in a relationship for a long time, for 11 years, but sadly that came to an end. And now at this stage of my life, it's a little harder to meet somebody available.
It's a very funny novel, but it's also a very hard read in parts, and we get some very brutal bigoted scenes in it. I'm just wondering, you must have had mixed emotions when you were writing the novel, did you?
Yeah, I did. I mean, I knew this was going to be a long novel. It's about 600 pages because it's set over such a vast terrain of history. And I knew that in doing that, I needed to lighten the mood a little bit at times. I wanted it to be funny. I've never really written anything funny before. Most of my novels, anybody out there who's read some of them will know that they're quite sad most of the time. So I wanted to kind of just make this a little bit lighthearted. I didn't want Cyril to be a victim of his times in too deep a way. I wanted him to struggle a little bit in his earlier life, but I wanted him generally to be a fairly optimistic sort, because his mother, who we meet in the early chapter of the book, who's only 16 when she's thrown out of her parish for being pregnant and unmarried, is not a victim either. She is a strong, independent girl, particularly for that time. So I wanted Cyril to inherit something of that from her. And I thought the way to do that was to just make him optimistic that no matter what happened to him, no matter what was thrown at him through his life, he would somehow manage to keep going.
What I liked about Cyril was he was, although he was very resilient, he could really improvise in different situations. And he was big enough to be able to work with and engage with people who were vastly different from him, who didn't share the same views, and also who were potentially very judgmental of him.
Well, he's on a journey through the book of education himself, both during the time that he's living in Ireland and when he moves to Amsterdam and subsequently to New York, before coming back to Ireland as an older man. So he is trying to understand not just the country that he came from, but who he is himself. He struggles with this a lot in his teenage years, but eventually he accepts that this is who he is, this is how he was born. And he's intelligent enough to wonder why is it that at times people are so difficult towards him, so unaccepting of who he is.
Did you learn a lot about forgiveness as you're writing this book? Because Cyril is a champion of forgiveness in lots of areas of his life. And he sees all the possibilities that that can offer within it.
I think I learned a lot about that in my previous novel, The History of Loneliness, which was a novel that explored the child abuse scandals in the church. And I approached that book as somebody who had spent a long time feeling very angry towards the church, so angry that I wouldn't have been able to write that book 10 years earlier. I approached that book trying to see what it would be like to be a priest today, an elderly priest who has committed no criminal acts, but is kind of tarred with the same brush as those who have committed those acts. So in that way, I was trying to understand forgiveness there. I was trying to kind of approach it from a less judgmental way. That was my first book set in Ireland, and I followed it up with the Heart's Invisible Furies. So I think I'd already started on that myself and my own way, trying to understand the country that I've come from and experiences that have happened to me over my life.
Doyle Aaron and a lot of different personalities from Ireland's past feature in the novel, and it made for very entertaining reading, because there is those who are TDs for frequenting the canteen, coming in for their cups of coffee, but we also get towering literary figures and other areas are alluded to other characters or personalities in Irish life. What were you trying to do there?
That's something I've been doing since my first novel, The Thief of Time, which was published about 17 years ago now. I've always liked the idea of bringing real life characters into the fiction, putting words into their mouth and seeing what happens. And so in this book, yeah, Brendan Behan shows up at the Palace Bar for a scene when he's talking to the 14-year-old Cyril and Julian and their girlfriends at the time. And while Brendan Behan is, I think, an amusing character in the book, he says some funny things, he scandalizes one of the girls. He can also see right into the heart of Cyril. He can see what's going on. He says, "I can see right through you." Mm. And he challenges Cyril to look at himself. Eamon De Valera, Charlie Haughey, they show up in the book. I guess I have a little bit of fun with Charlie Haughey at times. I went into the Dáil when I was writing it. I went into the tea rooms. I spoke to some of the people who'd been working there for decades, and they gave me some of the nice little details about how the tea room operates in terms of when TDs come in and where they're allowed to sit, who they sit with, and the power in that room is not with the Taoiseach, it's with the kind of the woman who runs that tea room. You do not cross her.
Can we talk about Alice Woodbeat? She's a very charming character, a very engaged character, a very adaptable character. She marries Cyril pretty early on in the book. Can you talk to me about that? Because it is a reality that you will have, you know, gay women and men who do marry or have children and then things fall apart.
Yeah, she's a very, very important character in the book. As you say, she marries Cyril when they're both about 28. And this is the point in the book, really, where Cyril he's making the worst mistake of his life. He hasn't been able to come to terms with who he is, and he feels it would be easier for him if he simply marries a woman. over the years, of course, that has happened, as you said, you know, so many times, I'm sure, over the decades, where gay men and women would marry just to get the suspicion of homosexuality off their shoulders. Certainly in times like the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, there would have been jobs that would have been very difficult for a gay person to hold down. And there's a cruelty there. You know, it's while one can sympathize with the person who has not been able to be themselves in life, you are forcing this onto an unsuspecting other. And I think that's quite sad and quite harsh, especially when you think that, you know, for all those years as well, it was a country that didn't have divorce. So once you were in, you were in. Alice then, when, you know, she then has to live a life without Cyril because that marriage does not last very long at all. And when we meet her again, though, she's torn between a certain sense of bitterness towards him and a sense of, like, practically wanting to kill him half the time, but also an affection for him. And she's trying to understand what he went through because she is a kind, forgiving, thoughtful person. But she can't and she shouldn't put aside the fact that he has caused her great trouble in her life.
I thought it was a very interesting exploration because from a reader's perspective, it's difficult to knock Cyril all the way through the book because he gets so many knocks through life anyway. And it's very hard to make a call on just how selfish that decision was. There's blurred kind of moral stuff at play there. So it's very hard to figure out. So you're in between as a reader.
I'm glad you say that because I feel in novels, that's what you should have anyway. I think in novels should represent real life. And in real life, we're all capable of kind acts, generous acts, and also acts of great cruelty towards others. None of us are perfect in that way. And I like the idea of somebody reaching the end of one of my novels and not being quite sure where they stand on that character, whether they sympathise with him or think he's a bit of a pig, really, at times. Mm-hmm. And certainly when I was writing it, I felt that way. I felt there was times where he was behaving terribly. I think that is terrible. I can understand why somebody would do it, but I don't think it's justified. I think you still have to recognise that the person you are condemning to basically a loveless and sexless marriage is a complete innocent. They didn't ask for any of this. And there are ways out of that. I mean, you could just leave the country, which Cyril does. But I like the idea of readers then being able to, you know, talk about the book and talk about characters and have differing opinions on it.
You must have had great fun writing Julian's character because his throwaway comments are very lively and very energetic. Although he's a very flawed personality, he's very endearing in a lot of other ways. He's very redeeming in other ways. He's a lovable rogue, yeah. And but he's also a very interesting type in how he engages with the world and sees the world as his oyster. So, and his trajectory, without putting in any spoilers, is very, very interesting. So that must have been an interesting journey for you to take.
Well, Julian is actually, though, a very, very honest character, and he does no harm to anybody. He is ludicrously promiscuous, but he makes no secret of it. And he sleeps with every woman that he can, you know, that he can possibly sleep with. But he doesn't promise them anything. He's very clear about who he is, that this is the life he wants to live. And I think he's a very good-hearted character. I think I set out imagining that I was probably going to make him a bit of a pig, actually, himself. But I had too much fun with him, and he's kind and he's loving and he loves his sister very much. He loves Cyril very much as his friend. And he feels very betrayed when he discovers that Cyril has had this longing for him for decades. You know, he feels like, you should have told me. Cyril feels, well, if I had, you wouldn't have been my friend. And that's open to debate. But I realised that actually I just wanted to make Julian very honest and fun and let him have his way with whoever he wanted.
The title of the novel, The Heart's Invisible Furies, is absolutely beautiful. It comes from a comment Hannah Arendt made about the poet Auden. I presume you've enjoyed Auden's poetry through the years.
I have indeed. And actually, I read a very, very great debut novel earlier this year called Larchfield by Polly Clark, which is partly about Auden. But I love this line. She said that he had the heart's invisible furies carved on his face. And anybody who has seen Auden, particularly in his later years, will recognise what she means. And I use that line in the book at one point. It's quoted. And it just seemed right because I hope the book has a lot of heart, but there's a lot of anger in it as well.
that was writer and literary critic John Boyne. The Heart's Invisible Furies is published by Penguin and retails for just under €15 in paperback. Next up, it's British novelist and short story writer John McGregor.
Talking Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.
And you're very welcome back to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's great to have your company this evening. Well, tonight I'm coming to you from the 2017 West Cork Literary Festival, where the best in Irish and international writing talent gave a series of readings, workshops and lots more to some very happy camping readers. On Thursday evening, one of Britain's most exciting writing talents, John McGregor, gave a stimulating workshop on the art of letter writing, followed by a series of readings from his latest book, Reservoir 13. I nabbed John just after his reading for a chat about the book.
Hello, my name is John McGregor. I'm a writer and I also teach creative writing at the University of Nottingham. I've published 3 novels and a book of short stories, and my 4th novel, which I'll talk to you about this evening, is called Reservoir 13, which tells the story of a 13-year-old girl who goes missing from a village in Derbyshire in the heart of England, and about what happens in the village in the 13 years after she disappears. So I'm just going to read you a small part from that, starting about halfway through the book. The missing girl's name was Rebecca, or Becky, or Bex. She would be 17 by now, and the police published a computer-generated image of how she might look. There was something about this approximate Becky that seemed too smooth, as though the Becky in the picture had been kept in a sterile room and was only now coming out, blinking, unsteady on her feet and with no more sense of the world than the 13-year-old child who had gone in. The police said they hoped the increased publicity surrounding the image's release would encourage people to rethink their movements at the time of the girl's disappearance. There were dreams about her appearing on television again, gazing at the cameras as she was hurried from a car to a house in a London street, unable to talk about where she'd been. There were dreams about her crawling through the caves, her clothes smeared with mud and tar in the dark. There were dreams about her held captive, in basements and isolated barns, always with something across her mouth or her eyes. There never seemed any way to stop it. She had been looked for everywhere, and she hadn't been found. The allotments were cold and bare, exposed on the high ground to the wind which came scouring up the valley. In his greenhouse, Clive was laying out seed potatoes, half listening to Susanna Wright, who was leaning in the doorway with a seed catalogue. She was telling him about the heritage varieties she was planning to order. It sounded quite the quantity. Her voice kept going up as though these were questions, but he didn't think she was asking advice. He wasn't going to offer if it wasn't called for. He did know that no one had successfully grown globe artichokes on this site yet. Through the iced greenhouse glass, he could see the tops of the beech trees bending in the wind. There was Jones, leaning over his spade, digging over his entire plot once again. The man had a love of bare soil that was hard to fathom. Jones was keeping his eye on the old Tucker place. He cut the ivy back from the windows and went up a ladder to clear the gutter. It would do no one any favours if the place went to ruin. His sister wanted to know where the Tuckers had gone and who would move in next. He said he didn't always have the answers. He asked her not to ask so many bloody questions, and when the tears came, he said he was sorry. It went on like this. This was how it went on. I mean, I guess the questions I was asking myself through the whole writing process was just a really kind of straightforward, what happens next? What happens to these people next? Because there's a really interesting problem that I kind of created for myself. But I kind of came up with the structure before I'd come up with the content, essentially. And I knew I wanted the book to happen over a long period of time, and I picked 13 years. And I knew that I wanted every month to kind of be portrayed very rhythmically, and I wanted a very kind of rhythmical structure where time steadily moves forward. And once I'd started writing that, I realised that I'd kind of cornered myself. So I couldn't, like, the book opens with the girl disappearing, and I had dozens and dozens and dozens of pages of descriptions and narrative and the police investigation and the exploration of the caves and all this kind of stuff. But actually, the structure I created, I could only spend 2 or 3 pages on her disappearance and the search, and then we get to January, and then there's a couple of pages more, and then it's February. And so we keep moving forward. And so with each of the characters that I kind of created, I'd spend some time working out, okay, well, this woman is in her mid-30s, and she has two sons who had just become teenagers, and she's dealing with the death of her husband, and blah, blah, blah. And I work out very clearly who she is. Right, a scene with a few pages. But then the next time I come back to her, it's maybe 5 years later, and her sons are suddenly 18, and they're going off to university, and they've moved on from the death of their father, but she probably hasn't so much. Meanwhile, an old boyfriend has come back to the village, and she's wondering how to respond to him. Meanwhile, she's turned 40, and because of just the way time is passing, I kept having to find new things that happen to people, and life is what happens as the years go round. You know, things don't stay the same. You know, some people's relationships last their whole lives, and that's wonderful, but even within that there are difficulties and there are changes, and it's change. Everything's always about change.
One of the things I found interesting is that how you reflected on nature and the changes in the seasons, the changes in the local environment, and that pace that you brought with it. I'm curious, you live in a city, yet you have made nature almost a character in this novel.
Yeah, I was pretty intimidated when I started writing this about village life, about rural life, and writing about nature, because there are three things I know very little about. I grew up in a small town, and I guess as a kid, as a teenager, I'd spend a lot of time kind of walking and cycling out in the countryside, but I still lived in a town, and now I live in quite a big city. And again, you know, I spend weekends walking out in the hills or cycling or whatever, but I don't know those places. And I probably, when I started writing this book, probably only name four or five birds by sight, you know, and don't know any insects. So I had to do a lot of research, a lot of reading, a lot of like listening to bird song on YouTube, you know, all these kind of bits and pieces. Because I wanted to have a kind of equivalency between the cycles of the animal's life, or the cycles of the, I don't know, like the annual life cycle of the trees or the crops, and the weather patterns, to have those be equivalent to what was happening in people's lives, and kind of just kind of keep jumping from one to the next. I started doing that, and I really liked the rhythm that it created. Mm.
One of your characters is a caretaker, and halfway through the book, it comes out that he gets caught for having pornographic images on his computer. And I find that very, very interesting theme to explore, because clearly he's a very vulnerable character, but he's in a school, and he's access to young people. So just want to know, what were you doing with that?
Yeah, I was really interested in the perspective. I wanted there to be this real kind of gossipy feeling, and this kind of almost kind of voyeuristic feeling, without ever pinning that to anyone. Mm. And so I was using the passive voice, and, you know, so-and-so was seen leaving somebody's house, or so it was said about so-and-so. So nobody ever takes ownership of this gossip, but it's kind of permeating the village. And I mean, everyone's like that. All communities are like that. And it happens in cities as much as it happens in villages, but there's something about a small community where it's probably more claustrophobic or more kind of overbearing. Mm. You know, if you leave somebody's house early in the morning and you're seen, you know that's all around the village by the end of the day. Mm. And the thing with Jones the caretaker, you know, when you come up with characters, you start off with a very kind of sketchy idea of who they are, and you gradually start filling in the details, and you gradually start writing them into more and more scenes and giving them more and more kind of choices and more and more agency, and you just kind of, you take these little unexpected turns, and I think there was a point when I wondered if he might be an actual suspect in the disappearance of the girl, and I didn't want that to be the case. But there was something that was just really off about him, and I just decided, you know, what would happen if it turned out that he seems like a decent guy, but at the same time, he's got this pornography, underage pornography on his computer, and he gets caught for that, and so everybody finds out about it, and it's, you know, he's kind of disgraced. But also through that, I wanted to explore the reactions of the villagers, because I was really interested in this idea that there's, you know, universally paedophilia is seen as wrong and like the worst wrong and evil, and yet at the same time, culture and society tolerates this kind of objectification of teenage girls, 16, 15, 14. There's a kind of creeping tolerance of that, which is seen as being completely different from paedophilia, but which actually is treating children as adults. And so I was using the fact that Jones was caught for having this pornography and was imprisoned for it to explore the reactions of some of the other men in the village to what he'd done, and a couple of them kind of downplay what he's been caught for, which feeds into some of the talk around the 13-year-old girl who's disappeared, and some people kind of, you know, saying things like, well, she looked older than 13, or, you know, there's this kind of horrible, it's tolerance, you know, it's this kind of creeping tolerance of male violence and male possessiveness and male kind of presumption. And I was really interested in exploring that.
One of the interesting aspects of this book is that there's no easy answers. Nothing is summed up for us. There's no great resolution at the end. And there's a lot of uncertainty throughout the different stories within the narrative of what's really happening and what's been observed and what's been presumed. And some readers may find that frustrating, and others will enjoy that, and that will keep them reading through. But were you conscious of that?
I was really conscious that I wasn't going to provide a resolution. And I was really conscious that, I don't think this is a great spoiler, I don't know what happens to the girl. I very deliberately didn't make any decisions about what has happened to Becky. There are lots of possibilities. And I wanted her to be a teenager because I wanted her to have some agency, and therefore she may have just run away, you know, or she may have tried to run away and it hasn't worked out, or it has worked out and she's fine, she's just elsewhere. Or a number of terrible things could have happened. You know, I wanted to keep it very open. And I wanted it to be about what happens when you don't find out the answer. And so it would have completely undermined that to then find out the answer, or for me to know the answer and deliberately hide it from the reader. You know, it's open, we don't know. And I was really conscious that some readers would find that frustrating, partly because we're kind of conditioned to get answers from novels and to get resolutions and to get, you know, this kind of crossword puzzle solution. And I know that some readers feel cheated by the end of the book. But, you know, that's how life is. Yeah. Like that's how life works.
Yeah. And is it your job to have a nice, tidy, neat little ending? Like, is that your job as a writer? Do you need to have to spoon-feed your readers?
Well, no, that's it. I don't think it is. There's a perfectly respectable tradition of thriller writing which does that job, and that's great. I was interested in exploring what happens when there is no answer, you know, and there are people, you know, we can all think of who are living with that lack of knowledge, that lack of resolution.
That was British novelist and short story writer John McGregor. Reservoir 13 is published by Fourth Estate and retails for just under €17 in paperback. Well, that's it from Bantry and from Talking Books for another week. I hope you enjoyed the show. Now, before I wrap things up tonight, I've a handy little competition for you from the good people at Books Ireland. All you have to do is answer this fairly straightforward question, and the first email to talkingbooks@newstalk.com wins an annual subscription to Books Ireland. So here it goes. Best of luck. José Eduardo Agualusa recently won the 2017 International Dublin Literary Award for his novel, A General Theory of Oblivion. What country does José come from? Is it A, Angola, B, Portugal, or C, Mozambique? Okay, all that's left for me to do now is to say a very big thank you to all the team at the West Cork Literary Festival for putting together such a lively and entertaining programme, and especially to the super-organised Jean Kearney of Kearney Media Communications in Cork City, and to Festival Director Emer O'Herlihy. We've been talking books. I'd like to end tonight's broadcast with a reading from Colm Tobin, who rocked the house down on Wednesday night with a series of readings from his latest novel, House of Names. Good night.
Been acquainted with the smell of death, the sickly sugary smell that wafted in the wind towards the rooms in this palace. It is easy now for me to feel peaceful and content. I spend my morning looking at the sky and the changing light. The bird sound begins to rise as the world fills with its own pleasures, and then as day wanes, the sound too wanes and fades. I watch as the shadows lengthen. So much has slipped away, but the smell of death lingers. Maybe the smell has entered my body and been welcomed there like an old friend come to visit. The smell of fear and panic. The smell is here like the very air is here. It returns in the same way as light in the morning returns. It is my constant companion. It's put life into my eyes, eyes that grew dull with waiting, but are not dull now, eyes that are alive now with brightness. I gave orders that the body should remain in the open under the sun a day or two until the sweetness gave way to stench. And I like the flies that came, their little bodies perplexed and brave, buzzing after their feast, upset by the continuing hunger they felt in themselves, a hunger I had come to know too, and come to appreciate. We're all hungry now. Food merely whets our appetite, it sharpens our teeth. Meat makes us ravenous for more meat, as death is ravenous for more death. Murder makes us ravenous, fills the soul with satisfaction that is fierce and then luscious enough. Greater taste for further satisfaction. A knife piercing the soft flesh under the ear with intimacy and precision, then moving across the throat as soundlessly as the sun moves across the sky with greater speed and zeal. And then his dark blood flowing with the same inevitable hush as dark night falls on familiar things.
Talking Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.